So, the title of my paper today is on learning language. I must confess, I'm really at a loss to know what one means exactly when one makes use, as we do very often in philosophy, of the concepts of nature and culture, particularly in order to try to make out what language is. My paper today is motivated by the hope one could cast some light on this distinction by investigating the phenomenon of language learning, and more precisely, the phenomenon of the early learning of language. In other words, this phase of childhood when human beings begins to acquire language. I must also admit that I would be satisfied if I had succeeded in setting the problem, or at least in showing how difficult it is to set this problem. To begin with, I will make some remarks about the meaning of the pair nature-culture in respect of its relation to language. Language, one often says, is the main criterion of the belonging to a culture, in the anthropological acception of this word. Lévi-Strauss, for instance, claims in a famous interview that, quotation, language is the cultural fact par excellence. In his opinion, the leap into culture, the transition from nature to culture, these are words he uses, are done when the articulate language is mastered. And this is true, as it seems, both from a phylogenetic and an ontogenetic point of view. So one could quite rightly say that for a human being, leaving animality and becoming a human being requires to learn language. But once such has been said, there remains the question as to whether becoming a cultural being belongs to human nature or not. Is human being made up so, physiologically or genetically speaking, for instance, that learning and using language is only a development of an ability which is given to him from the very beginning of his life? In fact, in my opinion, this analysis is not clear enough. A remark must be made about the respective scopes of the two previous claims. In the text I quoted, the criterion of Lévi-Strauss is mainly descriptive. He speaks of presence of an articulate language as a criterion of culture. So culture is meant in a way which does not contradict the possibility of a natural, physiological or genetical foundation of a cultural fact par excellence. Lévi-Strauss aims, in other words, at distinguishing humanity from animality in respect of their ways of living, not at proposing an ontological hypothesis about the linguistic ability. One conclusion may be drawn from this train of thought. On a linguistic point of view, it seems possible to distinguish radically culture from nature only if one considers the ability in language and its ontological status, since the fact that human beings use language only provides a descriptive criterion. This specific distinction amounts to asking the question, is this ability set in human body from the outset, or is it introduced by a process of learning? In other words, does language learning only consist of an actualization of a natural potentiality, the diversity of languages being only an epiphenomenal fact on this view, or is this very potentiality constructed? This alternative leads to construe the distinction between nature and culture as a version of a classical distinction between innate and acquired. But there are at least two difficulties which prevent me from simply accepting the latter. First, how are we to draw a clear limit between what is innate and what is acquired? If the neurological capacities, for instance, of human beings are certainly a condition of the linguistic ability, nevertheless, may one say that this ability is one of their destinations? Second, what one might want to call the nature of a human being in order to investigate the ontogenetic process of a transition from this being to the linguistic ability could turn out to be the mere result of a far longer phylogenetic process which is already determined by cultural features. As Pascal claims in a famous remark, quotation, custom is a second nature which destroys our first nature. But what is nature? Why is custom not natural? It is to be feared that this nature is a first custom, as custom is a second nature. End of quotation. The entanglement of phylogenesis and ontogenesis makes the limit seem once more very difficult to see. And one may even wonder whether it has any sense to undertake to separate what is innate from what is acquired. Whatever may be the relevance of this last statement, it seems quite clear that the distinction which I have challenged is expressed in philosophy by two main and opposite trains about the relationships between language on one side and culture and nature on the other side. The first train claims that the ability in language belongs to, is already in some way or another, human being, and hence that it has not to be brought in. One could add that even if our neurological apparatus is not intended to make us able to speak, it is a fact that this apparatus is a widely sufficient condition. Of course, the opportunity of learning and the utility of using language are required, but only as far less important conditions. Such a view, an illustration of which may be found in Chomsky's thesis of the existence of a quotation language acquisition device inside the human mind, such a view may be considered as a certain kind of naturalism. According to it, the linguistic ability is already at home in the learner, and thus his referential relation to the world is not a problem. The second train claims that language is a wholly artificial and arbitrary symbolism which the learner masters in no way when he undertakes to learn it. The linguistic ability would be something which is first out of us, and the language the child learns something as a foreign land which he would have to step into. Such a view may be considered as a certain kind of conventionalism. The referential relation to the world is problematic, and this is the reason why the acquisition of the ability in language is so unsure. One can find in Quine's view on language this conception at work. I would like now complete this sketch with three remarks. First, I do not claim that any serious philosopher or psychologist of language has ever frankly adopted one of his views. I only claim it is less, but much more interesting in my opinion, that philosophers and psychologists are very often faced with this alternative, and that their constructions very often consist in putting the stress on one view without rejecting the other. Second remark, though one is the opposite of the other, these views share two very important and perhaps hardly acceptable presuppositions. The first one is what I would like to call the myth of a threshold, a gap were to be crossed if one wanted to leave nature and get access to culture. It should be crossed, in particular, to reach the linguistic ability. Sure, both views do not agree with one another on how to cross this gap, since for naturalism it is already crossed, while for conventionalism it has to be, and eventually it cannot be. But they both agree with the idea that it is meaningful to wonder whether such a crossing can be achieved. Naturalism says something as, do not worry, we are already on the right side, while conventionalism complains, my God, how far is the other edge? The second presupposition concerns the way one has to answer the question, what does to possess the ability in language consist of? I explained some remarks ago that the distinction between nature and culture how difficult it may be to see it clearly is mainly relevant when one considers the ability in language in its ontological respect. The notion of linguistic faculty has been considered as something well known, but what does it consist of? Naturalism and conventionalism share a second presupposition in this respect. They both consider that this ability consists of something as a theory, that is, that there are some principles the child would have to master, whatever may be the way of this mastering, to be able to grasp the meaning of language and to use it. I will make it clear and show how crucial it is later in my paper. Last, this is my third remark. I know that it must sound rather paradoxical to put Quine among conventionalist thinkers. Fortunately, this is not my aim. I only mean that one finds in Quine's analysis the idea that the rules which govern language and make it a meaningful symbolism must be introduced in the learner by a training. This is the word Quine uses in modern object. The child's behavior looks like a materia prima that must be shaped so as to give it the required form. And at first, this behavior is unshaped. This artificialism is a point that Chomsky has pointed out when he writes in his famous review of Skinner's Verbal Behavior, but it also for Quine, quotation, if it were true in any deep sense that the basic processes in language are well understood and free of specious restriction, it would be extremely odd that language is limited to man. End of quotation. Of course, Quine makes some concessions to the natural aspect of a linguistic ability. But I do not mean that his position is simply a conventionalist one. I only mean that there is, in his thought, a certain trend, the pure version of which I have tried to make explicit. I would like now to fasten my foregoing analysis to the question of learning, specifically. My thesis is that neither naturalism nor conventionalism can give a satisfying account of what language learning is, but each one for a different reason. On the one hand, the naturalist trend does not succeed because it implies that there is no such thing as learning. Since the language faculty already belongs to the natural apparatus of a future speaker, there is no need for it to be acquired. It has only to be actualized, one may say. But how could there be something as language learning if there is no linguistic ability to be acquired? Consequently, no real learning occurs on the naturalist view. What one ordinarily calls language learning is not a relevant expression. The concept of culture and the belonging to a culture is only one way of naming a part of our nature. Chomsky even states in a paper that the expression language growth might be less misleading than the expression language learning. On the other hand, the conventionalist trend fails to account for language learning because it makes it rather unintelligible. For the child who is learning language, to know what the word used by the teacher refers to requires to know the meaning of the word which refers to this thing. Without that, how could the child know that the teacher refers to the whole object when he says, for instance, this is a ball, and not to the form, the stuff, the number, or the color of his object? In this respect, it seems that the beginning of a process of learning language would require, in fact, that this process had already come to its end. The concept of nature and the belonging to nature of a child seems to exclude the concept of culture and the belonging to culture as something which is beyond the child's reach. So, while for naturalism the process of learning is already over, for conventionalism it can never really begin. One is never sure whether he has really learned the language he tries to learn and not another one. I shall put this in other words. A very classical question of the philosophy of language is, How can language grasp the world and tell something about it? How can language to be bound to it? How can language be bound to it? My question is different from this one, though it is closely linked with it. I would like to ask how the teaching of language can grasp the learner, and how the latter can grasp the language and the way it is bound to the world. Or, what does the efficiency of grasping must consist of when language is passed on a child? The classical scene of a learning of language is described as a relation made up of verbal and gestural incentives from the teacher and of right or wrong verbal behavior from the learner. Then my question becomes, what do these incentives and reactions must consist of in order to succeed? What does exactly happen when they occur? So, how to conceive the very relation? Whose questions lead to the following one: what is passed on as language is taught and learned? And I meet once again the question of the content of the linguistic ability. The myth of a threshold casts a mysterious light on the previous questions. And I will try to answer these questions in order to explain this myth away. How will I investigate this problem further? In my opinion, two great philosophical books at least have been written in the 20th century about language learning: The Philosophical Investigations by Wittgenstein and Word and Object by Quine. But why and how do I want to use and combine them in my paper? Quine's and Wittgenstein's views on learning language may seem to be both very close to each other. Think of the naturality of learning, the necessity of training in order to master language, the care of describing what happens without postulating inner processes, as Chomsky does, and very far from each other, mainly because Quine's view amounts to conceiving the learner situation as the one of an already skilled speaker. Of course, I should do for Chomsky thought the same as for Quine's, but my paper will restrict itself to Quine's. First, because Quine's view represents the very conception, in my opinion, Wittgenstein challenges on the question of language learning, in particular in the Philosophical Investigations. Second, because this view is pervasive, very pervasive, in the contemporary philosophy of language. So I would like to examine now language learning as a behaviorist views it, and Quine's Skinnerian analysis. I would like to outline some features of the way Quine articulates the questions of meaning, of translation, and of language learning. Of course, I am far from claiming to exhaust Quine's view. I would rather like to underline the features which justify my previous statement about the conventionalist character of the Quinean conception of language learning. Admittedly, Quine's behaviorism is methodological. It roots in Skinner's analysis of verbal behavior. Though Skinner does not develop the question of language learning on its own account, Quine gives a mention of his psychologist in his analysis of the ontogenesis of verbal behavior as the origin of his own analysis. What are the main tenets of a Skinnerian account of verbal behavior which are relevant for the problem at issue? Broadly speaking, Skinner is a psychologist who corrected and complexified Watson's scheme stimulus response thanks to the introduction of a third component in the description of behavior. This third component is the reinforcer, the old pattern of reinforcement, as Quine says. For instance, if the utterance of a word is the response to some stimulus and is rewarded by an adult, one has to say it is reinforced by this rewarding and that it is no more a mere respondent to the stimulus, but rather an operant, since from then on the child who has uttered the word, will utter it again in order to get the rewarding. The response is no more the mere effect of an event coming from the world, the stimulus, but the means to produce an event in the world, the rewarding. This is why Skinner calls it an operant and considers it is not necessarily preceded by a stimulus. Within this framework, language learning consists in acquiring a verbal disposition, that is, a disposition to utter such and such words or sentences in such and such situations, in a way taken for right by the community the child belongs to. This acquisition is done thanks to a process of selectiveness by the means of reinforcements and discouragements that shape the child's verbal behavior. Dismissing the myth of meaning or the illusion of subject matter, Quine may define the meaning of a sentence first of all as a stimulus meaning in the following words, quotation, "The stimulus meaning of a sentence for a subject sums up his disposition to assent to or dissent from the sentence in response to present stimulation," end of quotation. Of course, this is not the whole of Quine's analysis of meaning. The chapter 2 of Word and Object draws up the Quinean typology of sentences and distinguishes the case of a translation of a term from the translation of a sentence. But the point of my paper is not there. It is that resulting from a behaviorist formulation of a question of meaning, one main tenet of Quine's view lies in the assimilation of a child who learns language and of a linguist who faces the task of radical translation. Quine claims indeed that radical translation, it is a quotation, radical translation begins at home. The way a linguist undertakes the translation of a quotation, the language of a hitherto untouched people, is the same as the child's when he begins to learn his language. It is worth saying that the radicality of a situation of translation is required by such an assimilation. The linguist must meet a wholly unknown language to face the same problems as the child. He and the child have not yet any disposition to understand the unknown language. They share this situation and so the need of observing the behavior of the speakers of this language and of producing inductions, the result of which will be reinforced or discouraged. Quine writes, quotation, "What the linguist must do is guess from observation and to see how well his guesses work," end of quotation. And there is something very similar in his description of the early language learning insofar as the child also has to rely on the agreement in stimulus meanings, it's a quotation, in order to begin his acquisition of language. Put differently, both of them have to rely on the fact that the association of a word with a stimulation is reinforced or discouraged by those who master the language, a native or a teacher, according to the case you consider. One would find out the same proximity between the linguist and the child when Quine states his famous principle of indeterminacy of translation and the ancillary thesis of inscrutability of objective reference. I explain shortly, as there are many different processes of acquisition of language from which one and the same verbal behavior results, there are also many different and possible manuals of translation which give a satisfying account of one and the same verbal behavior. Of course, this point could be developed further on. So what is the matter with this analysis? And I would like to consider now what Wittgenstein explained about language learning. The striking similarity between the two following texts is worth taking notice. The first text I would like to quote is a quotation from the very beginning of Quine's Word and Object, and the second one, the quotation from Augustine by Wittgenstein at the very beginning of the Philosophical Investigations. Quotation of Augustine, "When they, my elders, named some object and accordingly moved towards something, I saw this and I grasped that the thing was called by the sound they uttered when they meant to point it out. The intention was shown by their bodily movements, as it were, the natural language of all peoples. The expression of the face, the play of the eyes, the movement of all the parts of the body, and the tone of voice which expresses our state of mind in seeking, having, rejecting, or avoiding something. Thus, as I heard words repeatedly used in their proper places in various sentences, I gradually learned to understand what objects they signified, and after I had trained my mouth to form these signs, I used them to express my own desires. End of quotation. It seems to me that one's attention must be drawn to how behavioristically this text can sound concerning the question of language learning. But I must be more precise, and I ought rather say that Augustine gives a mentalist account of meaning and a behaviorist account of learning. From this second point of view, his description reminds rather naturally this text, taken from word and object. Language is a social art. In acquiring it, we have to depend entirely on intersubjectively available cues as to what to say and when. Hence, there is no justification for collating linguistic meanings, unless in terms of men's dispositions to respond overtly to socially observable stimulations. An effect of recognizing this limitation is that the enterprise of translation is found to be involved in a certain systematic indetermination. End of quotation. Both texts refer to the situation of the original meeting of language by a young human being. They also both closely link the grasping of linguistic meanings to the observation of overt behavior, save that Augustine seems to take for granted that there are such linguistic meanings, while Quine dismisses such entities. Last, they both claim that a child learns language first by guessing which word refers to which object, and then by training to reproduce such a relation. Here is what I would like to claim about both texts and the way they account for learning. In order to explain my thesis, I shall discriminate two criticisms against the Augustinian Quinian view. First, in both texts, the description is unable to draw any boundary between the case of a child who learns language for the first time, as it were, and the case of someone who learns a foreign language. As recalled above, one has even to say that this is a thesis of Quine. The risk of such a fuzziness is, of course, the one of a petitio principii, that is to explain how language is learned by supposing that language is already learned. The Quine-Augustine's view is as seemingly self-evident as it is self-defeating, in fact. Second, and this is the main point, the problem is not so much the petitio itself than the mistake from which such a petitio springs, as if it gave a clear insight into a phenomenon of learning. The tenet shared by Quine and Augustine on the description of learning is that the main problem is what might be called a problem of access. As when an explorer tries to get access to a meaning of foreign expressions. In other words, from Quine's and Augustine's point of view, the problem of learning is how the child I am teaching can grasp that the word blue, for instance, refers to the color of his ball and not to its spherical form, etc. How can I make him guess this reference? I shall explain further these criticisms thanks to a reading of the beginning of Wittgenstein's philosophical investigation. And I think it can give me a great help. In the first remarks of this book, Wittgenstein discriminates two expressions, die hinweisende Erklärung, or Definition, and das hinweisende Lernen der Sprache, remark 6. He also uses the word Abrichtung instead of the latter. In his opinion, if one who learns language is stepping into a Lebensform, that is, in what might roughly be called a culture, this can be done in two different ways. This discriminating aims precisely at avoiding to confuse the learning of language and the learning of a foreign language. It is the very role it plays in those first remarks. This reading could be easily confirmed by other remarks as 208, in which Wittgenstein underlines the difference between teaching some concepts by means of an Erklärung to someone who already masters a language and teaching them by means of Beispiele und Übung to a child. So what is the point? One could say at first sight that the difference lies only in the impossibility when one tries to teach language to a child to use words to explain how another word means and is used, and that a child who learns language cannot more use such an explanation. However, if it were all, the difference would be very slender. It would only be a quantitative difference of learning means. In fact, there is a close connection between the distinction and what Wittgenstein wants to make his reader understand about the way language is meaningful. I faced sooner the question, what is passed on a child while he learns language? What is acquired when language is acquired? In Wittgenstein's opinion, the answer one will give to this question depends on how he conceives the way language is meaningful, the way it has Bedeutung, and the nature of a linguistic ability, the nature of Beherrschen. Quine would certainly not disagree with Wittgenstein in respect of his formulation of a problem, but Wittgenstein would certainly challenge Quine's solution because it corresponds precisely to the target aimed at by the philosophical investigations, as we will see. Quine claims indeed that no investigation is able to reach the objective reference of a term. From a Wittgensteinian viewpoint, one is led then to believe that das Lernen der Sprache besteht darin, dass man Gegenstände benennt. Man kann das eine Vorbereitung zum Gebrauch eines Wortes nennen. Aber worauf ist es eine Vorbereitung? Wir benennen die Dinge und können nun über sie reden, uns in der Rede auf sie beziehen, als ob mit dem Akt des Benennens schon das, was wir weiter tun, gegeben wäre. Als ob es eines gäbe, das, was heißt, von Dingen reden, während wir dort das Verschiedenartigste mit unseren Sätzen tun. Remarks 26 and 27. The mistake is to believe that to associate a word with something while learning language, schlagen eine assoziative Verbindung zwischen dem Wort und dem Ding, as Wittgenstein says, is the same activity as to play the language game of inweisende Erklärung. This is the reason why one may wonder, how can one know that this word refers to the whole object rather than to some of its parts, or to the shape of the object rather than to its color? A question which is asked both by Quine and Wittgenstein, but in very different ways. Language games, at the beginning of investigations, play a role of clarification in this respect. They disentangle the complex net of the uses of language by presenting linguistic situations simpler than ours, as it is already explained in the Blue Book about more narrow but not essentially different acceptance of a notion. Language games are the forms of language with which a child begins to make use of words. A famous quotation. Wittgenstein submits this famous example of language game to his reader, the following example of language game to his reader. A builder may ask to his man, bring me a slab, remark 2 and 8. The point Wittgenstein's analysis wants to make out is that if language were restricted to such a language game, that is, asking for some objects and bringing them, learning it would not require to discriminate between naming, benennen, slab, and ordering to bring a slab. Or rather, naming would be nothing but ordering, and succeeding in understanding slab would consist of in nothing but bringing it to the one who has ordered slab. As Travis observes about this remark, there is absolutely no difference between how to play with this word and what this word means. The meaning of this word is nothing but the way we relate to the world by its means. Put differently, there is nothing else to be acquired when a child acquires the meaning and the ability proper to this restricted language. Wittgenstein also says that the specific Unterricht the learning consists of determines what will be called the Verständnis, the mastering, of the words that are learned. And that, quotation, dabei teile ich ihm nicht weniger mit, als ich selber weiß. Confusing the two ostensive uses of language, discriminated above, leads to formulate the problem of language learning in a very peculiar way. Once the uses of language that are learned are reduced to the particular language game of Inweisende Erklärung, one will think that in order to learn language, a child must face, in some way or another, consciously or unconsciously, the following kind of problems. How is this language bound with the world? What is the meaning of such or such words, etc.? From then on, learning would require explanations of meaning as the Quanian explorer needs. On this point, this deserves attention that, quotation, wir können uns auch denken, dass der ganze Vorgang des Gebrauchs der Worte, in Bemerkung 2, eines jener Spieler ist, mittels welcher Kinder ihre Muttersprache erlernen. This is the remark 7. Such a statement is important because Wittgenstein also writes, quotation, in den Sprachen 2 und 8 gab es ein Fragen nach der Benennung nicht. And because it is important also because the impossibility of such a Fragen nach der Benennung for a language learning child is the very reason why das Inweisende Lernen must be distinguished from die Inweisende Erklärung. Of course, this does not mean one could. This does not mean one could not say that the teacher names things or that a child names things while he is learning language. The point is rather that das Kind noch nicht nach der Benennung fragen kann. Wittgenstein underlines the word fragen. What is the scope of such a statement? What does this inability of a language learning child entail? It seems to me that some features of a statement of a remark 6 deserve being taken into account. I would like to precise this point. First, if language learning may consist of a language game which uses Benennung, nevertheless, this game must not be assimilated to the one in which the child is able to ask for the naming, that is, to the Inweisende Erklärung language game. Because, and this is the point, that would amount to making language learning begin too late, which is the same as claiming that language learning never really begins after all. The child would learn language by asking questions that can be asked only once some language game have been learned. This is the petitio principii I have pointed to. As Wittgenstein writes, quotation, man muss schon etwas wissen oder können, nach der Benennung fragen zu können. And he adds one remark later, nach der Benennung fragt nur der Sinn wohl, der schon etwas mit ihr anzufangen weiß. Thus, not only explaining a word without the background of a certain knowledge of language would make the meaning of that word undetermined, but it would also be senseless, unsinnig versus sinnvoll, to imagine that such an explaining is possible. That is parallel to the following point. A language cannot be a foreign language to me if I have not already a language. So the child and the explorer are not in the same situation against Quine. Moreover, if a view challenged by Wittgenstein were right, there would be a discrepancy between what a child learns when he learns how to use a word and what the latter means. The Bedeutung of a word would lie hidden behind the obvious Inweisendes Lernen. To learn language would not show how a word belongs to our ordinary life, which role it plays in our activities, but only make the learner guess the meaning of it. The meaning becomes an reachable entity. We have seen that the confusion at issue produces this strange situation. One considers the language game of the Inweisende Erklärung without its ordinary background, that is, without the knowledge of the game of the activity in which the object named and the naming of this object take place. On Wittgenstein's viewpoint, views like Quine's thesis of inscrutability of reference spring from the very neglecting of such a background. Quotation: Wie aber, wenn man einwendete, es ist nicht wahr, dass einer schon ein Sprachspiel beherrschen muss, um eine hinweisende Definition zu verstehen, sondern er muss selbstverständlich wissen oder erraten, to guess, worauf der Erklärende zeigt, ob also zum Beispiel auf die Form des Gegenstandes oder auf seine Farbe oder auf die Anzahl und so weiter. This Einwendung is precisely what Quine objects to any conception which claims that one can grasp the objective reference of a term. Against the claim that the imagined indecision for the word gavagai that the linguist endeavors to translate in his own language, against the claim that the imagined indecision between rabbits, stages of rabbits, integral parts of rabbit, the rabbit fusion and rabbit hood must be due merely to some special fault in our formulation of stimulus meaning, and that it should be resolvable by a little supplementary pointing and questioning, Quine replies, point to a rabbit and you have pointed to a stage of a rabbit, to an integral part of a rabbit, to the rabbit fusion, to where rabbit hood is manifested. Point to an integral part of a rabbit and you have pointed again to the remaining four sorts of things, and so around. End of quotation. So, within the framework of Quine's analysis, one is placed in a situation in which the reference of words is widely inscrutable. This is the target of Wittgenstein's criticism of Augustine in 32. Because the child is taken to be a kind of linguist who tries to understand the foreign language, it is taken for granted, at least implicitly, that he already masters the language and consequently that his learning of language does not differ from understanding the Erklärungen that someone could give him. Thus, one could say that in Quine's view, the opposite of a child's situation is not the ignorance of any language, but bilingualism after all. Though it is a bilingualism with its own language, since the child learns and masters, at the beginning at least, only one language. Quotation, und nun, from 32, und nun können wir, glaube ich, sagen, Augustinus beschreibe das Lernen der menschlichen Sprache so, als käme das Kind in ein fremdes Land und verstehe die Sprache des Landes nicht, das heißt, so als habe es bereits eine Sprache, nur nicht diese. Oder auch, als könne das Kind schon denken, nur noch nicht sprechen. Und denken ist hier etwas wie zu sich selber sprechen. End of quotation. The words bereits and schon in this remark are a direct echo of a statement in the remarks 30 and 31 of a necessity of already mastering a language game if one must be able to use the naming language game. But, this is the point, the substitution of a linguist's case for the child's as a result of subtracting from a language game of explanation the background which determines the meaning of the word explained. This is the reason why reference seems inscrutable and has to be guessed. So, on the whole, there is one mainly mistaken feature in Quine's view. It is the idea that if words had an objective meaning, this ought to be something different from the use a teacher can show to his pupil. In this respect, Quine does not disagree with Frege's propositional realism that he challenges in lots of other respects. Since meaning in this acception does not exist, the child is doomed to guess what the word taught to him means. To this first idea, Wittgenstein replies that Quine adopts the sceptical picture of what might be called an under-meaning because his looking is turned towards a super-meaning. For his own part, Wittgenstein claims that the meaning of our words lacks nothing, but this can be understood only if one realizes that there is no discrepancy between the meaning of a word and its way of taking place in our lives or the world the roles it plays in the language games it belongs to. In this respect, the reference of the term Slav in the language game of the Remark 2 is not inscrutable, but perfectly determined by those language games. There is no meaning beyond. It has to be noticed that from this point of view, Chomsky's conception is exactly on the same level as Quine's. His distinction between performance and faculty presents the latter as something essentially different from the former. The meaning of words seems then to lie in the faculty, and the particular performances appear as some mere instances of language faculty. So, this faculty would always lie beyond any performance as something from which the latter springs. More precisely, though Chomsky puts it firstly inside the human mind, whereas Quine puts it outside, both of them consider that the principles ruling verbal behavior, whatever may be the way you conceive these principles, lie behind and beyond the language uses that only reflect them. For Wittgenstein, on the one hand, this is a typical philosophical misunderstanding of a distinction between the expressions mastering a language and using it, and on the other hand, this leads to misconceive what language learning is. One further consequence of a misleading distinction between the inweisende Erklärung and the inweisendes Lernen is that there must be an intermediary between the state of ignorance of language and the state of mastering it. Since the ability for asking, for naming, is projected in the learner's situation, and since, conversely, the learner's situation subtracts from the explanation its ordinary background and consists then in having to guess the meaning of words, the child is doomed to have recourse to a theory, that is, to a set of principles from which flow any possible meanings. The threshold to cross would amount to acquiring such a theory. If language learning consists from the outset of explanation of not directly graspable meanings, then the child has to learn a theory of the language he tries to learn in order to succeed in learning it. Within the framework of Quine's view, the child would have to construct a theory, a translation manual, in Quine's terms. He would have to construct a theory which is made up of analytical hypotheses, for Quine, and founded upon the processes of observation, induction, and reinforcement. Language learning would amount to constructing such a theory. Thus, when Quine speaks of training as a necessary component of language learning, it does not mean this word as Wittgenstein means Abrichtung. While for Wittgenstein such a concept aims at discriminating language learning from any explaining, that is, at excluding the picture of language learning as the acquisition of a theory, Quine's training is a part of the behaviorist theory of meaning, that is, it is a condition for the reinforcement to operate and to produce a specific verbal disposition. On this point too, Chomsky's conception crosses Quine's. The formal system and the recursive syntactic laws of a generative grammar is also a theory, save that it is already inside the human mind. Chomsky writes symptomatically, quotation, "It is reasonable to regard the grammar of a language L ideally as a mechanism that provides an enumeration of the sentences of L in something like the way in which a deductive theory gives an enumeration of a set of theorems. The child who learns a language has in some sense constructed the grammar for himself." End of quotation. Against such a conception, Wittgenstein substitutes the concept of Abrichtung for the one of Erklärung and the concept of Reaktion for the one of understanding and explanation. In the remarks, 143 and 145 of the Philosophical Investigations, it is very striking that the success of a child in getting the meaning is a certain way of reacting to the incentives his teacher gives him. This reaction is the criterion in the Wittgensteinian acceptation of this word, of a mastering of a learned expression. That is, it is what one ordinarily calls understanding or mastering the word. As the meaning of a word can be plainly shown and taught by a teacher, the reaction is not the mere outside symptom of the success in acquiring a theory, but the criterion, the definition of such a mastering. If language learning is certainly a means to step into culture, this stepping into does not require to cover the gap of reference by constricting or actualizing a theory, but rather to react as the teacher wants. Without according to it the importance it deserves, I can now explain why I cannot really agree with Cavell's view on how Wittgenstein relates to each other the notions of culture, nature and language learning. In his book, This New Yet Unapproachable America, Chapter 1, Declining Decline, Wittgenstein as a Philosopher of Culture, Cavell claims that the concept of form of life has a biological meaning in Wittgenstein's thought. Human being would be so physically made up that he has language and that he has it as he has it. I agree with Cavell on the idea that it belongs to what Wittgenstein calls the Naturgeschichte des Menschen to speak languages, and that his Lebensform is a speaking form of life, as Cavell says, different in this respect from any other animal form of life. However, I disagree with the word biological to the extent that it would mislead to give the status of an explaining to the concept of nature and to the idea that language speaking is a natural activity to human beings. Wittgenstein's viewpoint is a descriptive one, which means it does not substitute a naturalist view for a conventionalist one, but tries to describe as fairly as possible what we do when we learn and use language. If he claims that there is no threshold to cross to leave nature and become a cultural being, that does not mean, as for Chomsky, that the threshold is already crossed, but that there is no such thing as a threshold between the ignorance and the mastering of language. I shall conclude with the two following remarks. First, one has to take notice of the fact that for Wittgenstein, classical philosophy not only is unfair to the phenomenon of language learning, but also consists of the opposite process. The philosopher is no more at home in his own language as a child is not yet. He does no more know his way about in language as a child does not yet know it. If one follows Cavell's reading, one could say that the endeavor to live humanity is proper to human being, that is, it belongs to the speaking form of life, and this endeavor is called philosophy, what Cavell calls scepticism. Thus, one could call the philosophical activity a process of unlearning language. So, there is nothing surprising in the fact that a philosopher looks like a child in some respects. Wittgenstein observes, for instance, in the big title script, quotation, Erinnere dich daran, wie schwer es Kinder fällt zu glauben oder einzusehen, dass ein Wort wirklich zwei ganz verschiedene Bedeutungen haben kann. This was precisely the case with the word inweisen, as I have tried to show above. Moreover, I would like to venture the following exegetic hypothesis. Wittgenstein's thought is not only, not mainly, a philosophical thought about the question of language learning as about one of its application fields, but also, and firstly, a thought of which the phenomenon of language learning may be taken as a methodological tenet. I mean that for Wittgenstein, lots of contemporary philosophies of language are mistaken because of their failure to rightly describe the phenomenon of language learning. For him, looking at language from the viewpoint of a learning of it is a means of clarification, and looking at it, at this learning from the viewpoint of the already learned and acquired language, is a source of deep troubles. In order to suppress the mysterious aspect of a transition from nature to culture through language learning was certainly to take the former. Thank you.